Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the November 25th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is, What's the Difference Between a Rampaging Mob and a Righteous Protest? By Adam Gopnik. A critic at large, what's the difference between a rampaging mob and a righteous protest? From the French Revolution to January 6th, crowds have been heroized and vilified. Now they're a field of study. By Adam Gopnik. In the beginning was the mob, and the mob was bad. In Gibbon's 1776 Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, the Roman mob makes regular appearances, usually at the instigation of a demagogue, loudly demanding to be placated with free food and entertainment, bread and circuses. And though they don't get to rule, they sometimes get to choose who will. Gibbon was a sort of conservative radical, contemptuous of Christianity and attached to free-thinking Epicureanism, but fearful of social disorder. And by the mob, he meant the lumpen proletariat of any big city, his own London as much as his remembered Rome. What do you do when two mobs are shouting at each other during a public election? So Mr. Pickwick is asked in Dickens' Pickwick Papers, set in the 1820s. Shout with the largest is Mr. Pickwick's protective advice. In time, this fearful conception gave way to an image of the crowd that was mostly good, and when bad, more comic than anything else. In Charles Mackay's 1841 Extraordinarily Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, the people who swarm to buy tulips, bulbs in Holland or shares in the South Sea Company in London are frantic and mutually reinforcing, but their victims are chiefly one another. In a capitalistic society, the crowd turns inward, focused more on making money than on extorting it from power. Indeed, the crowd could now be thought of as the people, a concept that might merit approval, as in we the people, or abhorrence, as when the Nazis promoted the purity of the Volk, whose blood was being poisoned by outsiders. More recently, the crowd returned as a wholly positive force, full of collective savvy. We got books on the wisdom of crowds, while on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the best way of answering a specialized question was often to sample the audience, smarter as a group than any shrewd contestant alone. Crowdsourcing became a cheery thing. Then January 6th happened, and suddenly the 21st century quiz show crowd seemed to dissolve back into the Roman mob, violent seditionists instigated by a demagogue and aimed at the destruction of the very idea of law. Any such willfully succinct summary will, of course, be bound by a thousand quavers and qualifications, and by a larger question: have crowds actually changed, or is it simply that the words we use to describe them have altered over time? Are crowds in reality only ever-shifting gatherings of rational individuals, or do people, assembled together into a seething group, become, as the Bulgarian British writer Elias Canetti believed, a thing unto itself, acting in ways that none of the individuals in the group would have undertaken alone? The January 6th crowd was clearly composed of some who wanted to act and many who merely went along. Canetti distinguished between closed and open crowds. The open crowd, like the one that stormed the Bastille, is the kind in which many people of different allegiances come together for a common, if often ill-defined, cause. The closed crowd is an organized gathering for a predefined purpose. Whether you think of the Trumpite mob was a closed crowd, an assembly of paramilitaries with a clear goal of creating enough chaos to end the electoral count, or an open one, a confused agglomeration that scarcely knew where it was going or what it would do until it got there, probably affects your degree of panic or fear about what another Trumpite mob would do. Closed or open, crowds persist as historical agents and have become a field of study all their own. In his new book, The Crowd in the Early Middle Ages, Princeton, Shane Babricki, a medieval historian at the University of Iowa, describes a hinge moment in the way people have thought about crowds. It was a period when the rapid deurbanization of society had reduced or eliminated the Roman vulgus or mob, but when memories of Roman order and disorder lingered. Bob Ricky has devoted himself to a blessedly old-fashioned kind of scholarship, digging through ever finer shades of meaning, sifting through all the Latin terms that refer to crowds and mobs and gatherings. If you have long wanted to discern the subtle differences in medieval Europe between vulgus, plebs, turba, populace, and rustica, here at last is the book to assist you. And these differences do indeed have weight and significance. It's fascinating to learn how, when the vulgus was forced out of the dying cities and into the countryside, it became the rustica, the peasants with pitchforks. Plebs, meaning in classical Latin common folk, came to mean more neutrally the community. Bob Ricky assures us even vulgus could be just another equivalent of the broad populace that was now the lodestar of all crowd words. Bob Ricky has an ambivalent attitude toward the era of his attention. You would not take up medieval history as a subject if it held no appeal to you as an object. Gibbon's take could be simple. Life had been better, and then it was worse. And though the causes were complex, Christians and barbarians both playing a part, the result was clear. Bob Ricky, by contrast, describe what looks like a catastrophe, but labors not to characterize it as such. One day there are hot baths in Britain, the next there weren't. The thinning of the population, which attended what he does not call the Dark Ages, we are assured, did not make for a better or worse society. Yes, it did. Prosperous and library-bound Roman civilization, however lamed by cruelty, public execution, slavery, was clearly a better place to be than the one where all those evils persisted along with some new ones, and none of the good things did. In any case, early medieval Europe, noted for its deurbanization, seems like the nadir of crowds, closed and open. Bob Ricky notes, in a beautiful understatement, that it was undersupplied with gatherings. On the other hand, he writes, monks and nuns were crowd specialists, too, and that they connected themselves to a community that encompassed the living and the departed. A lovely poetic point, though not really what we mean by crowds. What he finds is the rise of the mini-mob. Given that travel was dangerous, dignitaries on the move surrounded themselves with an entourage. This invention proved so potent that we still see it today, as in the history of American hip-hop, whose top men, too, are often uneasy travelers. At the same time, the macro mob was demoted. In fact, the one powerful idea that crowds had a well-earned veto on rulers' bad actions was anathema. In medieval Europe, where crowds were often gendered and likened to hysterical women. The closed crowds of the period, in turn, included all of the liturgical processions and stage gatherings designed to create at least an illusion of what Bob Ricky calls the spontaneous unanimity. In one memorable incident, after a municipal feud in Ravenna around the year 700, ended in a red wedding-like murder of one clan by another under the pretext of breaking bread, the local archbishop commanded the whole city to perform a three-day liturgical procession. Bob Ricky writes, open crowds inclined to homicide could be turned to closed crowds performing penance. Bob Ricky ends with a series of questions. His purpose is to demystify the idea of a crowd as a single thing and instead make us feel it as ever-changing and contingent, sometimes being exploited by the ruling class for its own ends, held responsible for acts the rulers want to encourage and to disavow, and sometimes eerily amplifying the long echo of Roman ritual and literature. The New Testament, the holiest of texts at the time, is itself a Roman document depicting circumstances of a bygone era, including the city mob crying, "Give us Barabbas." Arguably the most important discursive function of the tumultuous crowd, Bob Ricky concludes, was not to condemn its activities, but to obfuscate them. Crowds and discourse were, above all, a tool of plausible deniability. Even in an uncrowded historical time, the idea of the crowd mattered as a concept, a dream, a way of thinking about the forms of popular sovereignty when none that we would recognize as quite such existed. In the past couple of centuries, speculations about the role of crowds have tended to center on the French Revolution, and yet the whirligig of classical and medieval terms remains relevant. Is the crowd merely a vulgus, the unleaded raving, or is it the populace, the community speaking? The French Revolution looms large in the philosophy of crowds because it was the first time that a mob, or what looked like one, was responsible for a decisive turn in the history of humankind. The Roman Republic was always an upper-class affair, with the mob a mere chorus, and even the American Revolution was, as students of Samuel Adams have learned, very much a legislative revolution made by the manor, with the crowds much smaller than they are remembered to have been. The Boston Tea Party was more a publicity stunt than a significant popular protest. But the French Revolution, though managed by an assemblage of grandees and ideologues, did involve a significant role for a large group of citizens acting on their own. Americans celebrate a group of merchants and planters signing a document on July 4th. The French celebrate a crowd of citizens storming the monarchical prison called the Bastille on July 14th. There is a difference. Yet the nature and role of the crowd in the French Revolution have always been contested. For British conservatives of the late 18th century, Burke most memorably, the swarming humanity on display was a vengeful monster of bloodlust and violence. This idea, taken over by the reactionary Thomas Carlyle in his History of the French Revolution, and then even more memorably dramatized by the radical Dickens in A Tale of Two Cities, was given a more scholarly treatment in the French historian Gustave Le Bon's The Psychology of Crowds, 1895. By the mere fact that he forms part of an organized crowd, a man descends several rungs in the ladders of civilization. Isolated, he may be a cultivated individual, Le Bon wrote. In a crowd, he is a barbarian, that is, a creature acting by instinct. Again, this view comes a counter tradition that saw the crowd effectively as the people enacting choices. This line of French left-wing interpretation reached its apotheosis in Jean-Paul Sartre's 1960 account of the storming of the Bastille, in which Sartre introduces the notion of a fused group to indicate the power of a crowd to mobilize chaotic emotion into compelling action. Sartre was too familiar with modern history not to see the fantastic potential of any street mob. But he has mainly a positive view of mob action, which could not only bring about political change, but provide a kind of shared existential epiphany. In moments of decisive action, we reach as a community beyond our mortal despair. Sartre's melodrama of the mob rather understates a larger truth. When the Bastille was at last stormed, there were perhaps 7 confused prisoners left inside, the population having been reduced by reform over time. The existential epiphany, as so often with Sartre, was purely theatrical. Camus once Sartre for snoozing during the liberation of Paris in a comfortable armchair at the Comédie Française. In the British historian George Rude's classic book, The Crowd in the French Revolution, 1959, one gets a more nuanced view of the same gang-ups. Rude breaks down the mobs of the revolution into their elements and shows that, far from being a kind of enraged, unitary monster of Lebrun's fearful description, they were made of precise social kinds, not the true lower ranks of French society, but what we would call the petite bourgeois, whose specific demands on the state seem best answered by group action. Neither a bloodthirsty, out-of-control monster nor an awakened community. The revolutionary mob was made of craftsmen, small traders, and so on, people who wanted highly specific things, such as more bread and better wages, very much like their lower middle class inheritors among today's French gilets jaunes. They wanted to protect their modest allotments from the vagaries of big government and the mercantile classes. The Bastille busters would not, in truth, have been disappointed to find only 7 prisoners in the Huskau. They aimed to make a point, not a prison break. And when the revolution was turned into the empire, there's a sense in which the rabble was reassembled when the emperor's Grande Armée arose. Indeed, as the military historian John Keegan says, inside every army is a crowd struggling to get out, and the single thing that commanders fear most is that their regimented forces will devolve back into a disorganized crowd. The British journalist Dan Hancock's in his new book, Multitudes, How Crowds Made the Modern World, Verso, goes much further than his scholarly forebears in the effort to defend the crowd from its defamers. He is an unstinting admirer of crowds and crowd action, not just as a means of social change, but as a heady social experience of transcendence. He evokes the thrilling energy generated by a political crowd in which one feels the crackle of history in the air. It follows the realization that your elected leaders will always fail you to one degree or another, whether by accident or by design, and flows from the refusal to accept these failings, taking democracy into your own hands, indeed your own body, and letting it guide you out into the town square. When you experience crowd power, he says, you are lifted out of the present and commune with the eternal crowd, the Bastille crowd. The crowd is how popular passion opposes power. His book contains, to be sure, moments in which he acknowledges that crowds may not have an unstained record, but he is reluctant to categorize the more unappealing gatherings as crowds at all. And the criterion for distinguishing virtuous crowds from vicious mobs turns out to be whether they share Hancock's politics. His position can be defended only by a series of Humpty Dumpty-like equivocations, in which words mean what the speaker wants them to mean. The January 6th protesters who stormed the Capitol, were they not a crowd as confident of taking democracy into their own hands as any other street army? Well, Hancock explains, they were not really a crowd. They were not a spontaneous, organic outpouring of mass popular resistance, but something instigated from the very top of American political life. Even if one shares his horror at the Trumpian rhetoric that helped to set them off, no one can doubt that the mass protesters certainly understood themselves to be an outpouring of popular resistance and, once unleashed, acted violently, incoherently, opportunistically, sometimes with a clear purpose, and often without, and all about as organically as you could ever want. The truth is that Dickens' vision of the maddened mob is hardly a historical fiction. Simon Schama's memorable history of the French Revolution, Citizens, though sympathetic to the Republican cause, found much to vindicate that the Carlyle view that there was at least latent evil in the revolutionary mob. Certainly, no one can whitewash the vengeful public rituals of the Jacobins, forcing whole families to watch the execution of their members one by one in the public square, while yes, the mob cheered on the killings. Nor does anyone dispute that a Parisian crowd, having taken over a prison, murdered the helpless Princess de Lamballe, mutilated her body, stuck her head on a pike, and paraded with it in front of the Queen's residence, hoping that she would see what happened to her friend. The mob may well be manifold, made of many kinds, with many purposes, some benign, and still prove murderous. Hancock's would direct our attention elsewhere, focusing his disapproval on the state forces that would contain mass action. And so he praises at length the British crowd that, in 2020, in the city of Bristol, tore down a statue of a slave dealer and philanthropist named Edward Colston, and threw it into the water on the perfectly understandable grounds that the slave dealer had been responsible for the enslavement and death of enormous numbers of people. Yet if a mob of morally enraged Thatcherites assembled to destroy the giant bust of Karl Marx in Highgate Cemetery on the grounds that his ideology contributed to the needless deaths of millions, Hancock's would doubtless find much less to praise in their passionate commitment to their cause. Nor would his admirable crowds be capable of action in the first place if they were innocent of orchestration. The Sink the Slaver crowd in Bristol was, if not controlled from on high, then certainly no less planned in advance than the Stop the Steal one, hashtagged at a distance, with the whole fueled with encouragement provided via Twitter and Facebook. The rioters who attacked a mosque in the British town of Southport this past summer, after three children had been stabbed by someone described wrongly as a Muslim immigrant, were just as self-organized and spontaneous as the Bristol crowd, and in another way just as mediated by their own programs of social media encouragements. What difference would Hancock's maintain exist between the two? Surely the Southport rioters felt exactly the same indignation at how badly their elected leaders had failed them as Hancock's reports feeling in elections to his causes, and the same wild thrill at finally feeling free to act against perceived injustice. When you are taking democracy into your own hands, what you have in your hands is not democracy, because democracy begins with the recognition that other people have hands too. The violent Hindu mobs that periodically set upon Muslims in India, sometimes mobilized by an espoused cause no greater than the protection of cows, are just as spontaneous as any of the direct action protesters whom Hancock celebrates. Everyone was saying, what about going through the official channels? Hancock's writes scornfully about those who condemned the rioters in Bristol. But nobody was saying that. What they were saying, beginning with Keir Starmer, then the new head of the Labour Party, was, what about submitting our passions to a democratic procedure? Believing in democratic procedures is not a way of rejecting popular sentiment. It is a recognition that popular sentiment is always dangerously divided. When two mobs confront each other, there is no saying which will yell louder. Starmer had to condemn the rioters' actions, if not their purpose, because he understood that what is actually the largest crowd, i.e. the governing community of citizens, was opposed to mob action even when it approved the rioters' ends. The Theodore Roosevelt Monument in front of the American Museum of Natural History in New York, with its subordinated black and indigenous figures, was taken down by peaceful action and institutional process, and has been remarkably unmourned. Tellingly, there is not a single reference in Hancock's book to American Southern lynch mobs, yet they were the very model of spontaneous and organic popular uprisings, street gatherings in defiance of the impotent local police. The absence of imposed state order is exactly what left the poor black victims swinging. All the heady emotions that, for Hancock, signal the presence of a popular crowd on its spontaneously organic duty gripped those people, too, as they grinned at their hideous handiwork. The eternal truth from Rome to now is that one man's rampaging mob is another's righteous protest, and the line between the open crowd and the closed, between searchers fired up activists finding meaning and Carlyle's crazed mob seeking blood remains ever-changing. Crowds really are emergent entities, just as Canetti thought. People will do together what they might never do alone. This can be a positive and community-building emotion. Crowds supply the reinforcing circles of mutual trust, and often the simple insulation of numbers that keep the authorities at bay. In the carnivalesque spirit, we can be emboldened to laugh together at jokes at the expense of the powerful. But the permission granted by aggression can also be a wholly cruel and destructive force. That Southern lynch mob brought together people who went to church on Sundays and lived in peace with their black neighbors most days. The point of liberal democracy is to draw group emotions into peaceful contests and orderly exchanges without trying to reduce the passions that produce the crowds in the first place. As in Dickens, we want to shout with the loudest crowd, but first we want to make our own crowd the largest, allowing us to shout. We live in fear of what a mob might yet do. We live in hope of what peaceful protests might yet obtain. This ambivalence is built into our social existence, and there's no running away from it. Can we speak of the wisdom of crowds? Sometimes. The madness of mobs? Sometimes, too. Perhaps within the winningly minute range of terms that Bobrycki captures, vulgus and populace and the rest, lies a truth that resonates through centuries, even millennia. We see the shifting varieties of human assembly and search to give them meaning when the meaning lies exactly in the mutability. To turn a crowd into a mob is always easy, nor should we be surprised when 4 days later or 4 years later, the anarchic mob resisting power becomes the power to be resisted. A crowd can become a mob. A crowd can become an army. To turn a crowd into a community? Ah, that's the hard work. Adam Gopnik, a staff writer, has been contributing to The New Yorker since 1986. His books include The Real Work on the Mystery of Mastery. Personal History. The Long Way Home After a Canceled Flight. Had I proposed earlier that we invite someone stranded to come with us to New York, Hugh would have said no, but now there was really no way for him to back out. By David Sedaris. Ordinarily, I hate staying at someone's house, but when Hugh and I visited his friend Mary in Maine, we had no other choice. There weren't any hotels on the small island where she lives in the summer, and she'd seemed so genuine when she extended her invitation that we really couldn't refuse. Mary and he went to college together 100,000 years ago, back when tuition was affordable and you could study things like acting without bankrupting yourself. Her auburn hair had turned mostly white since I'd seen her 15 years earlier, and she wore it in an untidy bun. There was another old classmate of Hugh and Mary's at the house that weekend. Luckily, his girlfriend was there as well. Thus, there were two of us who felt left out when the talk turned to former teachers and whatever happened to so-and-so. Mary's secluded four-bedroom house was deep in the woods, yet still on the waterfront. The bay she faced was quiet and as calm as a pond. It was August and we'd hit a patch of perfect weather. The days were warm without being hot, the sky blue and cloudless. I do have one rule, she said when we arrived. No cell phones, iPads, or laptops on the ground floor. You what? I thought. But it was her house, and so for the first time in recent memory, I spent 2.5 days talking to people and having them talk back. It was shocking to see no one staring down at their devices. That said, at our ages, we sort of needed them. Did anyone see that movie? The funny one, directed by the Greek, who did that other movie about what's-her-name? Oh, you know, it starred that actor. She was on that British TV show. A phone would have moved us along quicker. Still, it was refreshing not to have one. No photos were shared, no social media posts. If you wanted to check your email or text someone, you were free to do so in your second floor bedroom or up in the third story crow's nest, but then you'd miss whatever was being talked about. That was the rub, since anything said by our hostess and two fellow guests was far more interesting than a 15-second video of a Komodo dragon eating a baby goat. I don't know how Instagram tagged me as a person who wants to watch this sort of thing, but it was right on the money. I wish I could say I spent 3 days entirely offline, but I had my Duolingo streak to maintain, so I sneaked off twice a day and did my German lessons while getting my steps in. The coastal Maine landscape was not familiar to me, and I found it singularly beautiful, the pines, the rocks, the cattails. One afternoon I saw a bald eagle, and the next, one of those eerie 12-foot-tall Home Depot skeletons in someone's front yard. It wasn't standing upright, but rather was on its knees, looking as though it was struggling to get back up. The skeleton wore a star-spangled vest, leading me to wonder if it wasn't some kind of political statement. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Compared with England, where I'd been only a few days earlier, the people on the island were remarkably friendly. Every driver that passed me waved, and the clerks in the two small grocery stores I ducked into were warm and chatty. While walking on that first afternoon, a man stopped his truck, introduced himself as Rocky, and asked me what my favorite color was. "Do I even have one?" I wondered, looking at him through the passenger side window, on which rested the head of a panting dog. "Red," I said, just to offer an answer. Rocky rooted around in a cloth bag beside him and handed me a tomato-hued flashlight the size of my penis when I was 12. Thanks, I said. Our dinners on the island were well thought out and prepared. Everyone but me was a terrific cook, and after eating, we spent hours around the table talking about America the way people and a play might. I liked seeing Hugh in the context of his old friends. The affection and respect he had for them was evident and put him in a good mood that lasted until we headed to the ferry that would take us back to the mainland. "Just so you know, you are not doing your stupid Duolingo in the car," he said through his teeth, smiling at the others as he waved goodbye from the driver's seat. He was very handsome. Everyone says so and always has. Take a picture and he's guaranteed to be the best-looking person in it, unless you're at the Emmys or in Brazil. You never have to ask him to do something tedious or horrible. Fill out visa forms for Pakistan, for instance. He is honest to a fault and true to his word. The trade-off is that he doesn't travel well. Once he reaches his destination, he's fine. It's the door-to-door part that's difficult, especially for me, who has to endure his short temper for however long it takes to get from point A to point B. "It's not like we're walking to Maine," I'd reminded him on our way to Heathrow at the start of our trip. "You have absolutely nothing to complain about." This kind of talk only makes him angrier. "You can work anywhere," he'll remind me. "I'm the one being uprooted." Sometimes a third party can tamp down his fury. His sister Amy, for instance, whom I began to wish we'd brought along. "Just so you know, I am doing my Duolingo in the car," I said as we left the gravel road that led from Mary's house to the paved one, since another thing I've learned over the years is that tiptoeing around Hugh only makes him crabbier. "Which line do I get in?" he demanded as we reached the ferry dock. He asked this as if I'd spent my entire life on the island and traveling to the mainland and back was something I did every day. "This woman here might know," I said, rolling down my window. "She's on foot," he snapped. "How can she help us?" "Okay," I said. "Then how about the person over there with the uniform on?" That was when he noticed a sign telling us which line we should be in. "Just put your arm back in the car," he said, adding for the second time that morning that as someone who'd never got his license, who couldn't be bothered to even do that, I had no idea what he was going through, which was true. It was a short ferry ride to the mainland, under 30 minutes, and by the time we arrived, he was reasonable again. Then came an uneventful hour-long drive to Bangor Airport. It was a Sunday, so there was no traffic to speak of. In the terminal, I bought a coffee and answered some backed-up emails. We were scheduled to leave at 4 and had just lined up to board when the gate agent announced an hour delay. Uh-oh, I thought. It wasn't that I had to be home by a certain time. It was that Hugh can't handle any change of plans. Though the airline might chalk up the delay to bad weather or a maintenance issue, he knows the truth. And the truth is, it's all my fault. Come 5 o'clock, it was announced that, owing to thunderstorms in the New York area, we would now be taking off at 7:30. I didn't like this any more than anyone else. Still, I kept my disappointment to myself until around 6, when they announced that our flight was canceled. At about the same time, the flights at the gates to the left and the right were canceled, as well. "Should we rent a car?" I asked. "So, what, you can drive us?" Hugh snapped. His tan, which brought out his lovely blue eyes and the silver of his hair, made him extra handsome. I'd been going to say as much, but instead I walked away thinking, I can't deal with you right now. With all the canceled flights, the first thing to do was to find a nearby hotel. All the choices were bad, but there's make your own waffles bad, and what are these bites on my stomach bad? So I called the nearest make your own waffles bad. When I told Hugh I'd booked us a room, he said that he'd had a doctor's appointment the following morning and announced that he would be renting a car and driving. This in a tone that meant, whatever you do is your own business. That's what I suggested 10 minutes ago, I reminded him. But I was talking to the air. He was halfway to the escalator by then. Enterprise had nothing left on its lot, so while he got in line at Budget, I got in line at Hertz and ceded my spot to him when it turned out to be our only option. While standing beside me, furious, he called our travel agent. According to my phone, it would take around 7 hours to drive to New York, and that was without the heavy rains and possible flooded roads we had been told to expect. Are you sure you can drive that long? I asked Hugh, who has sciatica. Also completely my fault because I control all the nerves in his legs. Yes, but you are not doing Duolingo in the car, he growled. I mean it, too. One lesson, and you and your little flashlight are going to get out and walk the rest of the way, and you will be sitting upright in the front seat, not lying down in the back. Your job is to keep me awake. Understand? Our travel agent secured us one of the last available cars, and while Hugh filled out the paperwork, I studied the crowd around me. Aside from children, most everyone seemed to have at least one tattoo, a lot of them on exposed legs, even people you wouldn't expect them on, a grandmother, for instance. The withered butterfly on her ankle resembled a crumpled post-it note. The only person I spotted without one was a young Asian woman who was seated on a bench beside two large knapsacks. She wore black patterned leggings with a light jacket and was talking to someone on the phone who seemed to be giving her bad news. The woman had a Chinese accent and perfect English grammar. Excuse me, I said after she hung up. Where are you trying to get to? New York, she told me. Up close, I saw that she had a stud in her nose and 5 delicate rings in each ear. I looked across the room at Hugh. New York where? Manhattan, she said, the Upper East Side. Do you know how to drive a car? I asked. She said that she wasn't great at it, but that she did have a license. Come with me, I said. I'll get you to the Upper East Side. Hugh was still filling out forms. This is Susan Dew, I told him. She'll be riding with us and driving part of the way. Does she need to show you her license or anything? The look he gave me was not one I had never seen before. That said, it had been a while, not since I'd offered his mother's Paris apartment to someone I'd met on a train platform. But he's a kid, I'd argued in the young man's defense. Think back to when you were his age and how happy this would have made you. And it's only for 6 months. Had I proposed earlier that we invite someone stranded to come with us to New York, Hugh would have said no. But Susan Dew, who had to be at work the next morning performing a job I did not understand, was so grateful that there was really no way for him to back out. The car we'd been given was massive, with 3 rows of seats. You can take the front, I said to Susan as we walked through the lot with our luggage. It was still light outside, but the sky was clouded over and ominous looking. How do I work this stupid navigation system? Hugh demanded, not pressing the screen on the placemat-sized monitor so much as punching it with a finger. Why couldn't they just give me a map? What's wrong with a goddamn map? Susan acted upon him like a tonic. Here, she said, let me take care of it. When she deftly connected her phone to the screen, Hugh became a different person, at least in regard to her. I just don't know why they make it so complicated, he muttered, no longer sounding angry but helpless, left behind. Let me know when you want me to take over, Susan said. I really appreciate this, by the way. She told me that when I'd first spotted her, she had been on the phone with her mother-in-law. She did not want me driving all this way on my own, so she found a flight out of Portland that will not leave until 11 tomorrow morning and was going to cost $700. Hugh told Susan about the friends we had visited. We went to school together at Northwestern. Where did you go? He asked her about her husband and her job. I listened for a few minutes and then moved into the third row of seats, stretched out with my iPad, and did German lessons until my eyes crossed and it was dark outside. I just closed my Duolingo app when my sister Amy sent me a link to a New York Post article about a man who'd put a 2-foot-long eel up his ass. The beast had chewed through his intestines, and now the guy was wishing he'd given the idea a little more thought. The comments tended toward, must be a Dem and a libtard for sure. Why all the anger, I wondered. At around 10, I asked Hugh if he could pull over at a Starbucks. He didn't, and half an hour later, figuring all the Starbucks would be closed by now, I asked if he could stop at a McDonald's. That way, if somebody wanted to use the restroom, they could, I said. McDonald's, he wailed. If his new best friend Susan Dew had asked, he'd have got off at the next exit, but I was apparently still paying for our canceled flight. Why not just a gas station? We could get food at McDonald's, I explained, thinking that maybe Susan was hungry, but had been too polite to say. You call that food, he said. Hugh passed a McDonald's, then another, and another, until around 11:30, at my insistence, he exited the interstate and followed the directions to one. Susan headed to the restroom as soon as we walked in. Is it unisex? Hugh asked me. I looked at him the way he deserved to be looked at. This is McDonald's, I said. They don't have unisex bathrooms. Well, how should I know? He said. Hugh had never been to a McDonald's until a few years ago, when we were driving from Emerald Isle to the Raleigh Airport. I guess I'll have a BLT, he said to the young woman at the counter. I'd said, they don't have BLTs at McDonald's. A few months later, again driving from the beach to the airport, but early, at 7 a.m., we stopped and he asked for a Danish. On this night, before heading out of the restroom, Hugh told me to order something for him. What have they got at this hour? He asked. You might be surprised to hear it, but their spaghetti and McMeatballs is actually very good, I told him. I'll have that, then, with a black coffee, he said as he walked away. I don't recall if there was music playing at McDonald's. Only one other table was occupied as we took our seats. I had ordered a Big Mac, and Susan, who insisted on paying, a piping hot casket of McNuggets, which neither Hugh nor I had ever eaten. Try one, she said. She had two sauces to go with them, one sweet, the other with mustard in it. I wanted to ask if Susan was really her first name, or if she'd chosen something that American might bother remembering. My friend Don once spent 4 months during an arts fellowship in the Xiangcheng region, and because her name made no sense, they gave her a Chinese one that translated to friendship flower, which is how I now introduce her to people. Did you read there was a panda born today? Susan asked. We talked about how ridiculously small their cubs are, no bigger than hamsters, and I asked why they have so much trouble reproducing. It's because their wombs are so tiny, Susan said. I suggested replacing the womb of a panda with a much larger one from a grizzly, and when Hugh poo-pooed the idea, I doubled down because there's no limit to what science can do now, and it's actually a pretty good idea. People are living with pig hearts, so why not at least give it a try? The other customers at McDonald's, a group of 3 teenagers, got up to leave. I watched them walk out the door, and as they headed toward their car, and one of them, a girl wearing a hooded sweatshirt, turned to look at us through the window. I wondered if she thought that Susan Dew was our adopted daughter. We're very proud of her, I imagined myself saying, as if this were the case, and the three of us were indeed a family. She went to NYU and now has a good job we don't understand. Susan, we learned, was from Yuyang, a city of more than 5 million in Hunan province. She had no brothers or sisters and had not seen her father. He and her mother lived separately for almost 6 years. I marveled at what a long way from home she was and at how much she managed to accomplish on her own. A lot of women would have hesitated to get into a car with 2 strange men. Was her fearlessness a Chinese characteristic, Or could she tell by looking at Hugh and I that we were harmless? I talked to some people earlier when we were upstairs at the airport gate, she told us. They said they were going to rent a car and drive to New York, but they did not invite me to join them, and I worried it was rude to ask. Had you gone with them, you couldn't have come with us, I said, not adding that I'd needed her as a buffer. And had you never come with us, I continued, we would never have gotten to experience the McNugget. For the next few hours, Hugh sat in the passenger seat and Susan Dew drove. It started raining soon after she took the wheel, lightly at first, then suddenly so heavily that the windshield, even with the wipers going, was like one of those opaque windows people put in their bathrooms. Let me drive, Hugh said, but it was too dangerous to pull over. The noise of the rain as it pelted the roof of the car was so deafening that I could hardly hear the developmentally disabled bachelor I was watching on my iPad. It was a show from the New Zealand akin to Love on the Spectrum. On that program, people with autism are set up on dates. On this new one, all the singles have Down syndrome and fall for their potential partners within 5 minutes of their first meeting. It doesn't matter what the other person looks like or what his or her interests are. They're ready to have sex, settle down, and stop looking. Hugh and I likewise committed pretty quickly. 8 months after our first date, we were living together. Now here we were, 35 years later, in our mid-60s, jerking and weaving through a rainstorm with Susan Dew. A truck passed, and as our car shuddered in its wake, another came close to us from the lane to the right of us. For a moment, I felt certain we would all die, and I laughed, thinking of how Hugh's family would react when they got the autopsy report and read that he had chicken McNuggets in his stomach. McDonald's? I could hear his mother say. What on earth was he doing there? The worst, though, thought occurred to me. What if Susan Dew and I lived and only Hugh died? What would it be like to continue on without him, to arrange his funeral and have people over to the apartment afterward? Amy would help with the food and so forth, but the whole thing, the whole time we'd be thinking of how much more smoothly this would be going if only Hugh were here to take care of it. I know we don't have a choice in these things, but I really hope that I die before he does, or that we die together. When the time comes, we can throw ourselves off the terrace, I'd proposed in our New York apartment a few months earlier. Hugh looked down at the street 20 stories below us. I don't want to make a mess and have the doormen see us like that. We put ourselves in body bags first, I said. Or no, first we load up on liquor and pills, then the body bags, then we jump. What if one of us chickens out at the last minute? This is Hugh in a nutshell. Okay, then. We'll both get into the same body bag. It won't be big enough, he argued. Are you worried about comfort in the last 10 seconds of your life, I asked. Believe me, the body bag will be big enough. If not, you can sew two of them together. I have the end of our relationship all figured out. It's just this next bit that's fuzzy. The rain let up around 1 a.m. Then both Susan and I had to pee, so we stopped at a gas station that turned out to be closed. As our car pulled into the lot, two men dressed in knee-length black coats, men wearing wide-brim hats, set their bearded faces bordered on either side by springy column-like curls, stepped out from behind a dumpster, tugging at their flies. Hasidim, I said the way I might have said deer. In the distance, through a stand of soggy, dripping trees, we could make out a shopping plaza, also closed. There were no other cars in sight, no homes. Susan walked toward the dumpster and reported that there was a security camera trained on it. Then she said, oh well, it is not like anyone here knows me. After she went, Hugh and I did too, though separately because he insisted on it. He doesn't like it when I can hear him peeing. Cover your ears, he'll shout from the other side of the bathroom door. I can completely see this with number two, but number one as well. I wanted to ask Susan if people said number one and number two in Chinese, but worried it might embarrass her, and so instead, I got back into the car and fell upon Instagram video of someone tweezing ticks off the head of a snake. There were five of them, gathered so closely to one another that they resembled a crown. He looked furious, the snake, much like Hugh had at the airport. Does he not know that the person with the tweezers is only trying to help him? I wondered. What are you up to back there? Hugh asked. Me? I said, nothing much. It was shortly after 2 when we dropped Susan Dew off on the Upper East Side. She offered to pay for half the car rental, but we wouldn't hear of it. It was our pleasure, we told her. I hopped into the front seat after retrieving her 2 backpacks, and Hugh and I, 10 blocks now from our own apartment, waited with the engine running until she was safely through her building's front door and well on her way to the elevator. David Sedaris has contributed to The New Yorker since 1995. His books include the essay collection Happy Go Lucky. Podcasting Department. Why NSA rules say no to smartphones, no to texting, yes to podcasts. The agency known for listening is getting into the extremely vetted talking game with No Such Podcast by Robert Sullivan. The National Security Agency's new podcast takes its name from the clandestine organization's own nickname. Cam Potts, Chrissy Wicks, Brian Fassler, and John Parker are all NSA employees. They were the winners of a talent search that was, given the nature of spycraft, held in-house, the house being a giant campus in Fort Meade, Maryland, where the specifics of what the employees do for the Defense Department is, to put it mildly, secret. The podcast, which is only 7 episodes old, is the opposite of some of America's top podcasts. In contrast to Call Her Daddy or the Joe Rogan Experience, the guests shared details about their sex lives or shards of climate denialism, respectively. No Such Podcast feels scripted, with 4 people in a secure NSA studio throwing around terms like mission capabilities and unclassed. As it happens, everything on the podcast is unclassed, i.e. not subject to security classification. I mean, before we even go on air, this stuff has been vetted, Wicks said, zooming with her co-hosts from NSA headquarters. Very vetted, Fassler added. Though it mostly feels like a recruiting tool, the frisson of proximity is the tease. A blurb from a recent episode. It's 3 a.m. A war is broken out halfway across the world. Someone needs to tell the president. The episode featured Doug Neiman, the director of the NSA's National Security Operations Center, or NSOC, and Yemi Rotimi, a systems analyst who works on the NSOC floor. Neiman recounted how the NSA helped get a child hostage released in an unnamed country a decade ago. He said, it's a great example of where the things that NSA does are not known by the American public, but they really make a difference. Rotimi recalled engaging with a member of the U.S. Cyber Command when in walked Dear NSA, being both the nickname and the acronym for the NSA director, General Timothy Ho. Uh-oh, Potts said. Pressure, Wicks added. You know, Rotimi replied. The vibe on No Such Podcast is relaxed. But Potts confessed to feeling some pressure to apply for the host job from his co-workers, who knew that he had a background in TV news at the NBC affiliate in Baltimore, his hometown. All 4 hosts grew up there. He described how his interest in the NSA was sparked by my very first breaking news assignment. An abandoned baby was found in the woods. Police called in a witness called the police, then tipped off Potts at WBAL. That led him to tell himself, oh, I've got to look into crisis comms. Online, he found an opening for an NSA communications officer. I applied, he said. I didn't look back. Brian Fassler was invited to try out for the host job when he was auditioning for a voiceover on an internal NSA video. He came to the agency after the small local bank he worked for was bought by a larger one. My job went away, he said. The podcast devotees knew Fassler from his conversations with Vin Nguyen, the NSA's chief responsible AI officer, in an episode titled AI and the Future of National Security, when, in describing the ways in which the NSA monitors the military plans of foreign leaders, said, what we found was that AI can be embedded through the entire intelligence analyst workflow. Christy Wicks came to her host role after working TV news jobs in Nebraska, Virginia, and then Baltimore, where she was recruited by the FBI as an intelligence analyst. 15 years later, she wound up at the NSA. "I moved from telling secrets to keeping secrets," she said. Wick's favorite episode of the podcast is The Women of NSA, Codemakers and Codebreakers. It concerns Elizabeth Smith Friedman, a Shakespeare aficionado who, during the Second World War, cracked the German Enigma machine using pencils and paper, and also Deborah Plunkett, who got into code breaking in the 1980s. On her very first rotation, she was in a target area and realized that the call signs of this country were using the French spellings of animal names. Jen Wilcox, an NSA historian, said, "Wick's co-host on The Women of NSA was John Parker, who once worked at Medieval Times, selling swords, shields, and knights' helmets. In an episode titled, What It's Really Like to Work at the NSA, Parker interviewed two other staffers about the long background checks, the repeated vetting and polygraph tests, and the no smartphones and no texting protocols, even when your wife just had a baby, as Parker's did just before you started the job. In contrast to the 21st century cyber threats they confront, NSA staffers' own communications are very 1991. That was kind of an adjustment," Parker said. Robert Sullivan is the author of most recently, Double Exposure. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.